Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregenauer with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregen. I think I mentioned one of my earlier shows that my students, I had 8 students in a small seminar in graduate school at SUNY Oswego, and they found out that I was, to their shock, what they described as a famous doctor who just happened to be teaching a children and mental health seminar to graduate students. And they were especially delighted when they just Googled Dr. Peter, and I was right up there among the famous Dr. Peters. So a friend of mine mentioned Ginger and Peter in a context in which she was thinking we would be fairly anonymous. She was just thanking Ginger and Peter in her publication without giving our names. And so I Googled Ginger and Peter. Now, if you put Ginger and Peter in quotation marks, which is how Google knows you don't want variations, you just want Ginger and Peter. In this case, Peter and Ginger. If you Google Peter and Ginger, we pop up. We are the Peter and Gingers of the world. Right away, all over the place, up comes our center and all. I'm going to get to my guest in a minute. I'll just say one word, Chris Ann. Her name is Chris Ann. She's a doc like me, and she's actually one of my most favorite people in the world. You know, if I just had an hour I could spend with somebody, I'd love to spend with Chris Ann. But she's also a very deep physician. And we're going to talk about traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress and the spirituality that brain-injured people can experience. And just really look at that in a way that only she can. But first I want to tell you about something more dismal. But first, Chris Ann, you there? You hanging in?
I am, and you're one of my favorite people, too. So thank you so much.
Okay, well, we're on the same page.
Exactly. Okay.
But I have to give the world the news of one more evolving psychiatric atrocity. And, you know, look for a psychiatric atrocity, and you're very likely to find behind it Eli Lilly and Company. Well, Eli Lilly and Company, through its minions, who are called researchers, but they should be called minions in the news reports, is pushing a new concept for children, to diagnose and drug children, called sluggish cognitive tempo. What is sluggish cognitive tempo? It is daydreaming. It's daydreaming, basically. But is it a subset? Is it a subset of ADHD? Or is it a thing unto itself, including drowsiness, daydreaming, lethargy, slow thinking? By the way, if we all haven't been through that while we were trying to be children sitting in a public school, drowsiness, daydreaming, I've actually done some of my greatest work sometimes in class, going off into drowsy and daydreaming. How many young women, and it's a picture of a little girl here in the one I'm looking at on something called Health News online, a little girl daydreaming. What little girl hasn't had sluggish cognitive tempo where she'd rather be thinking about poetry or a book she's reading, or maybe a boyfriend who's never recognized her in the halls, or being a doctor, whatever she's daydreaming about? So now listen, this is just the makings of another atrocity. They want to give these children Strattera, a poisonous drug with a suicide warning on it. a horrible drug. In the early studies done for it, a huge amount of overstimulation, anxiety, agitation, a dreadful, dreadful drug. And they now want to push it on children, not just ADHD kids, but sluggish cognitive tempo. This will jazz you up, kids. And the thing is, we don't usually get to see it evolve right out of, like, you know, I look at my lake and I see clouds rise from the Lake Hyuga. You can actually see the clouds. It was shocking to me that what they told me in school was true, that the clouds come out of lakes, you know. And I could see that. Well, now, because reporting is getting more sophisticated, we can see this horrible storm cloud rising because they're reporting how the researchers, including Russell Barkley, are involved with, not saying much about it, he refuses to answer questions, how they're involved with this pushing the new drug. Russell Barkley, why, you can write to him and spend over $100 and get a test questionnaire for sluggish cognitive tempo. And this is another doc who's pushing that he's just gotten funded from, guess who? Eli Lilly, the makers of Prozac and Strattera and Zyprexa, some of the most toxic drugs in the world. Eli Lilly, who's probably got more attention from the Attorney General of the United States maybe than any other drug company. Not sure about that, but they've just been involved with so many fraudulent things that have come to the attention of the government. So, look out, children. Look out. We're going to slap you with sluggish cognitive tempo and drug you. I don't want that to happen. I hope nobody in my audience wants that to happen. But now to a much happier note. Chris Ann Gordon. She spells Chris Ann, C-H-R-I-S, like Christopher Ann, A-N-N-E. She's a very bright human being. She graduated summa cum laude from the Ohio State University College of Medicine, took her undergraduate at Duquesne. She's kind of a heartland lady. What is she doing in Ohio? I guess she's a heartland lady. She's board certified in physical medicine and rehabilitation. And she now serves as a medical director at a hospital in Ohio. She herself had a traumatic brain injury, not from the service, which she will tell you about. And I think that, well, we know that encouraged her to go into the field. She has done a documentary on TBI, she's now created a foundation, and that's Operation Resurrection is the foundation, isn't it? Is that right, Chris Ann?
Actually, Operation Resurrection is the documentary, foundation is the Resurrecting Lives Foundation.
Well, I can be pardoned for confusing that. I'm going to just open up the mic to this wonderful woman, person, doctor, colleague, and let's start having a conversation about the, if you'd like to start with how you got injured, that might not be there, but anywhere you want to go.
Okay, well, I'll first start by saying you got the most important part right, Dr. Peter, and that is resurrection. For anybody who has ever had a traumatic brain injury, first of all, you know that there is nothing mild about mild TBI. If you've had a brain injury, if you've had a concussion, if you've been unconscious or kind of dazed for a period of time, then you realize that when your brain actually comes back to what General Lori Sutton of the former Army would call the new normal. You know, your brain definitely adjusts with an injury, and it's adjusting to the new brain that comes about that I think people find so hard, and I myself found very hard to do. And as I talked to you, Dr. Brega, when I first met you, I had a very interesting kind of situation with my TBI, traumatic brain injury, we call it TBI, was hitting my head against a cement wall while trying to push several hundred pounds worth of pottery underneath a crawl space. And the thing that I found most interesting is in a very split second, from the moment that the crown of my head hit that wall until the current time, my life has been never the same. Never the same. I went out and felt like I was going to become unconscious. I was out for a period of what I could gather later on, about 15 or 17 minutes. And when I came to, I realized I no longer was able to speak. And for those of you who know me, even Dr. Bregan will tell you right now, I'm actually speaking slower than I usually speak because I'm speaking to an audience. If I'm talking to Dr. Bregan, I just talk kind of like this and we kind of carry on a conversation. That's my normal speed.
Kazan, that was your normal speed before the injury?
Correct. Correct.
Well, that's interesting and amazing. By the way, you can call me anything but Dr. Bregan. Peter's fine. You're the first person to call me Dr. Peter. But dear, we are on a first name basis.
Right, but I like the Dr. Peter because, you know, you are my mentor. You know, as your audience knows, I'm in physical medicine and rehab. I'm not in psychiatry. I look to you for those answers and that direction, and so I really do kind of appreciate it. But I'll see. I'll see as the conversation goes on. But interestingly enough, I mean, I was unable to speak. I also had no feeling on the right side of my body. And early on in medical school, brain neuroanatomy 101, you know that you've got something going on in your left temporal area, the speech area. It's also the area that controls the sensation of the right side of the body. But I couldn't figure that out. I had no idea. And after I got up and kind of crawled up the steps from the basement, I remember reaching for a phone and holding it in my hand and thinking, I'm supposed to do something with this now. I had no idea how to call 911. I couldn't even remember 911. It wouldn't have made a difference because I couldn't have spoken anyhow. So that was my beginning of a new adventure, which was leading me down a pathway of traumatic brain injury recovery, which was not at all like we had read about in the books. You know, nothing that I had read or helped me before this day helped me get out of the funk that my brain was in. And it remained that way for about 6 to 8 weeks and then gradually improved over the course of about a year. But it was nothing mild about it. And I will say that when a friend of mine, I was supposed to meet them at a place, came to the house and I was able to answer the door, I was able to barely write down ER, okay, and they took me to the emergency room where my brain scan, my emergency CT scan was normal and a subsequent MRI was also normal. Meaning that in many of the places, and Peter, you will know this, in many of the places of this country, I would have been diagnosed as being, you know, out of my mind. Yeah. We've got a normal MRI. This woman isn't speaking. She must be trying to, you know, get off work. She must be trying
mutism.
To do some.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Selective mutism.
Exactly. Okay, there we go. Right. Right. So as I became aware of the fact that it was going to take me a while to get my voice back. As a matter of fact, I practiced very limited medicine for about 6 weeks and was able to communicate with my patients only by writing very slowly and them writing to me. Although I could understand their speech pretty well, I think most of them felt sympathetic for me. They had all, you know, were pretty shocked and kind of frightened because here's this person who talks all the time that, you know, the thing I love doing most, I cannot do. And so I was able to work my way back by learning how to sing and music and going over old tunes from the 70s and 80s, my era. I was able to learn to speak again, as well as going over things on the computer, because what I didn't realize before I had this head injury is that my memory that I always loved was a nearly photographic memory. I mean, I could read pages of medical text. And if you would ask me, you know, what does it say about Refsum's disease, I would tell you the page, the paragraph. And I thought everybody could do that. And suddenly I'm looking at very simple elementary textbooks online and not able to understand a sentence. So it was an enlightening moment in my life that you can have something so precious and within a millisecond lose it. And even worse, have no objective evidence on an MRI that there's anything wrong with you. So that was my beginning.
Now, it's typical, isn't it, that head injury often doesn't show up on MRI, just for our audience?
You know, only the very kind of what we call moderate or severe head injuries, you're absolutely right. Bad motor vehicle accidents, very bad falls, assaults, those usually have something that shows up. But as you were correct, in 94% of the cases, sometimes 98, depending on where you read, those studies are absolutely normal.
When did you reach a moment, I think this is going to be very interesting to people in a number of ways. First of all, okay, it's just interesting educationally. This is the most you've told me about it, I think. And it's very interesting to me. And it's also interesting human interest-wise. And it's interesting in terms of recovery, resurrection, transformation, transcendence, triumph, all those great words. Was there a point, and when did this happen, where you suddenly realized that you were speaking normally or comfortably again?
Yes, it was. But as we have talked about, I mean, in rehab medicine, in my practice, I use very little medication. I mean, I have primarily exercise-based practice, holistic-type practice. Mm-hmm. The moment that I could speak came about through the great use for a very short period of time of the medication amantadine, which is, for anybody in the listening audience, if you ever get the wonderful movie Awakening, it was the medication that was used after the major influenza epidemic, where many people got into almost like a Parkinson-like condition, which was the basal ganglia, the part of your brain that's your wake-sleep cycle and kind of gets you going. And that was the exact area of my brain that I had also injured. So I do remember...
That's lethargic encephalitis.
Correct.
And I've written a paper on that, folks, just to show you
Really?
I've written a paper on lethargic encephalitis that I delivered at... the Manhattan State Hospital with that famous neurologist doing the critique of it. What's his name? The man in a hat stuff, the man who treated
his wife. Oh, yes, and I don't remember his name. I'm so sorry. I can't help you there.
But I wrote a paper on it because the damage done is very similar to the damage done by the antipsychotic drugs.
Oh, gotcha.
They're almost identical. And the guys... Delay and Denniker, who first experimented with these drugs in Paris, said, we could produce something that looks like an epidemic of lethargic encephalitis with these drugs. And in fact, that's what we've done. We now have millions of people over the years, now hundreds of millions of people who have had injury to the basal ganglia, making them more lethargic. That's a side story I couldn't resist. So the amantadine, but just to make clear, we really don't have much difference at all, because amantadine, it was an attempt to stimulate a physical lethargy caused by a neurological disorder.
Correct.
And was not being used as a psychiatric drug to suppress or distort or help your moods. So
correct. Absolutely.
You don't prescribe antidepressants very much, do you?
I don't prescribe them at all.
Okay, folks, we can breathe a sigh of relief.
I don't prescribe them at all. I do prescribe, my anti-depression is exercise and Hershey's chocolate.
you got to add calling me to that list. It's easier. Much less work, and it's not fattening.
Gotcha.
So it was the amantadine
correct
that somehow just flip the switch for you.
Oh, and it was. Oh, and I'm so glad you said that, because I do need, this is a perfect place to bring this up. The one thing that I will tell you is, in medical school, you know, you learn about the gradual recovery of the brain and somebody who has a stroke and the gradual recovery. Well, when you have a traumatic brain injury, and we'll get into my work with our heroes coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, of which there are like 500,000 of them throughout our nation right now with traumatic brain injury. You know, when you have that, you can say, well, sooner or later I'll get better. No, no. I could not speak at all until the moment I could speak in a sentence. So it is really like within the traumatic part of a brain injury, every single pathway is laid down by your brain, very similar to a computer or electric circuit. Once the pathway is laid down, somebody flips the switch in your brain, and then you can do the activity. And I found that my recovery for each of the different things that I did was, it was not there until the moment it was there. And that I found fascinating. And I will tell you that it has been really helpful when I've been talking to my little soldiers and Marines primarily who are coming back, because I tell them, just wait. You know, they go, well, Doc, it's been, you know, then they're talking slower than that. Doc, it's been 6 weeks. And I'm not better. And I said, but you're not going to be better until the moment you are. But that way they don't get as discouraged or hopeless that they're not making any progress. Don't worry about that. Your brain will be laying down new pathways with some of the cognitive retraining that we're having them do, some of the great things that are on the computer right now that can help stimulate the brain. Once that pathway's laid down, there goes the switch and you're off. And every single person that I've talked to in my practice who have had a traumatic brain injury have noted the recovery that way. So it's very different than the recovery from something like a stroke or a bleed, you know, where you have to gradually pick up the blood and it has to be, you know, this is literally a damage to the axons, to the little feelers of the nerve, and once they're laid down, they're ready to go.
That's wonderful, interesting, encouraging.
Definitely. And the question is, how long a point it'll be from the time of injury and you're starting this recovery until it happens. Oh, you know what I tell my patients too? It is exactly like the last scene, when we were talking about, Helen Keller. So in that little scene where suddenly she realizes what water is, okay? I think it's one of the greatest scenes of any movie of all time. All of this time, you know, Annie Sullivan had been going on trying to teach her, and the moment that the switch, you know, was flipped there, she was able to communicate. And that's exactly how it feels like with a brain injury, with a traumatic brain injury.
Wonderful. Interesting. Have you written about this, by the way? I'm not sure you've written anything yet, have you?
You know, no, I haven't, but I was thinking.
It's going to be marvelous when you do.
Right, and what I really am in talking to one of my young heroes from Iraq, he served 2 tours of duty in Iraq and had 9 blast injuries. And by that, you know, for those who aren't, you know, kind of keeping up with the war, it's these improvised explosive devices which can literally lift up 7-ton vehicles and drop them back on the ground yards away. That's what these young men are getting, blast after blast after blast. And what Wendell, I just have to say, he was on 19 pills a day when I first met him. He became part of our documentary, which is all about solutions for our heroes coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And the biggest solution is getting collaborative efforts between the Veterans Administration, the Department of Defense, and the civilian world, since the civilian world represents 99% of the resources. So we were able to get him off those medications, and he started going to school, but to a community college. And I want to say that this is 4 years later, and this spring, he graduates from UCLA in pre-med. That is a difference. And you know, when I look at it, I said, just trust me this far. Let's get off these medicines and just trust me. Walk down the path with me for, you know, a few hundred yards, and then let's see what happens. And it's those small victories. you know, they keep us going on to the next thing. And just like he said, I mean, there was that night that he's sitting there studying his stuff when he suddenly says, I got it. I can take more than two classes now. You know, I mean, it is wonderful. And what I found out is that he had actually been the Southern California brainiac of his senior year. He had been in a scientific competition, similar to when they did like the university stuff on TV, ask a question, and he had won in all of Southern California. And I said, okay, we're going to draw on that. You know, science was your thing, we're going to draw on that. And so we just went over science and science and science on the thing. It's kind of like go over the things that you knew and bring them back. Now, that's what I did. Let me tell you, because my thing was math, and I lost my math, and I loved math, but I went over math literally an hour, if not two a day, for 6 months. And I mean, every night that I got home, I was just on that computer saying, you're going to learn this or else, you know? So it's a very interesting, takes a lot of perseverance. But if you're talking to people who have been there, done that, I think it's a lot more helpful than talking to people who say, you're crazy, take this medication. You know?
You know, the analogy I see in doing psychotherapy is a person finally getting the idea of what's meant by taking charge of yourself and your life.
Taking responsibility, okay.
taking over. And you look at all the ways in which people defeat that out of fear and guilt and shame and anxiety, and they keep backing off from, you mean I could really make my own life? I could say I'm in charge of myself. I could say to my negative emotions, I'm not going to listen to you anymore. I'm going to operate on being in charge. I'm going to operate on love. And sometimes, after a lot of repetition and work, all of a sudden the person gets it, and their whole way of talking changes from feeling helpless to feeling in charge.
And you know, that is the key. That's the beautiful thing. So what I'm hoping on doing, and I can talk to you since you're my mentor thereafter, but I would love to do a book about his recovery and my recovery. Because the most interesting thing, and I remember telling you about this when I first met you, Dr. Peter, at the Combat Stress Conference, and I just said that, you know, we can do so much if we believe in what we're doing. And, you know, I had to believe that my brain was going to get better, and my little patient had to believe that as well. So I'm hoping that in the book we can show that we had two very different injuries, two very different recoveries, but both of us would have been classified as having post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, kind of, had I been going to a Veterans Administration hospital, for instance, because I took their little screening test and I came out as having PTSD, you know, I would have been put down a whole different pathway than I did by getting to a physiatrist, a physical medicine specialist, who is actually able to jumpstart my brain. So it is a big difference. And as we had talked about too, any brain is very susceptible to chemicals. I mean, you take a look at people who are drinking alcohol and you know that the brain is very susceptible to chemicals. But a damaged brain, I think it takes, we had talked about this before, the susceptibility to the adverse effects of these chemicals, I think quadruples or even worse than that when you have a brain that isn't cohesive. What do you think?
That's absolutely true. That's why I say to people, if in fact it ever turns out that some of the things we call psychiatric disorders are in fact due to some chemical problem, I don't think that's going to happen, but if it does, the last thing you want to do is pile more chemical problems into your brain.
Right.
But don't even be waiting or hoping vainly that you have a biochemical imbalance and pouring the toxins in, because they're just going to make your wounded brain worse. So
right.
you want to do healing things for a wounded brain, and psychiatric drugs are not healing. That's not what they do.
Right.
We're getting near the half hour.
Okay.
When we come back, one of the things I want to talk about with you is spirituality in people who have been injured, finding purpose in life, a lot of positive things about all of this. This has been a wonderful half hour, and I want to continue with that. Are you good with that?
I'm good with that.
Okay, let's go to break, and we'll be back with Chris Ann Gordon, MD, in a few minutes, talking about more really interesting stuff about being a human being. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and this is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. And remember that, like all shows on PRN.FM, this is archived, usually the same evening, and you can listen to it then at your leisure anytime you want. Today's show is certainly one that folks may want to listen to again. My guest is Dr. Chris Ann Gordon. She is a physician. Her specialty is physical medicine and rehabilitation. She's from Ohio. She produced a film called Operation Resurrection about recovery from traumatic brain injury. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers have this problem, although certainly not all identified. And she founded the Resurrecting Lives Foundation. It's a 501c3. Welcome back on the air, Chris Ann.
Thank you so much.
Where would you like to take this second half of the hour?
Well, you know, let me first, I'm going to put out a little blurb there for people who are listening. When you and I were talking about the MRIs being notoriously normal in people with brain injuries, I did want to point out that the newer MRI machines, and we call it diffusion tensor imaging, kind of a big term, but the newer types of neuroimaging can actually show actually one or two tracks in the brain that are affected. So for all of our young heroes out there and their families, for all of our young athletes who have been injured, you know, there are primarily at most teaching hospitals the ability to get the newer types of MRI to prove where the lesion is. And I think that's very important because, you know, the Veterans Administration Hospital is so vast, and they really have had 3.2 million members now put on their books that they didn't have before these wars started 13 years ago. I don't expect them to keep up with that, but I do expect there to be collaborative efforts with the civilian world so that we can diagnose these properly. That's part of our Operation Resurrection mantra, and that is that the solutions for healthcare, education, employment in our returning heroes with mild TBI are right there. All we've got to do is all talk and work together, and we can get this done. So that's all I wanted to say with that disclaimer.
And keep in mind, folks, that most football players in high school are going to have some degree of head injury. There's no way around it.
Correct.
I remember playing halfback and deciding that the best runner in the county wasn't going to run over me, and he decided that as he approached that I must have looked much smaller than I felt. He tried to run over me, and we both collapsed in a heap, and I got up, and I touched my helmet, and it had a indent in it that looked like the size of a fist. So, you know, I never told that story before in public.
Wow.
So, you know, everybody who goes through sports,
right,
hockey,
right,
basketball, not to mention boxing and, you know, people are, what we're talking about today with the traumatic brain injury is occurring to millions of young people routinely through contact sports and even
correct,
some that aren't really contact, like basketball.
Correct.
Yeah, I'm right on that. I'm not exaggerating.
No, you're not exaggerating. They say that there's, you know, somewhere between, and here's what I love about these statistics. If you look up the statistics about brain injuries, people with concussion going to an ER, we hear every year in the United States between 2 and 4 million people go to the ER. Now, how can it be between 2 and 4 million? Can we not get closer than 2 million people gap there? But what everybody and everybody's statistic says is that's only a certain percentage of people who actually have them. So I do believe that the brain injury is universal. I do believe that we all can learn from, like, we can learn from the athletes can learn from our military, but it is an issue that we all need to take seriously now and work together to solve.
Hi, folks. I've never had this happen before. The line was cut off. Giselle, you got any, my engineer, got any idea what happened? No, okay. No clue, he types to me. He's shy. My line just went dead for some reason. And did you carry on? Did you talk some?
No, it went dead on my end as well, and then the music started playing. And as opposed to this never happening to you before, this kind of thing happens to me frequently, so I just waited till it all came back, you know.
It actually happened to you and I at the same moment on the air.
Exactly. And I consider that a divine thing. I mean, we're meant to talk about spirituality.
All right, let's go and talk. God bless you. Let's talk about spirituality.
Yes, let's do, because I am convinced about one very major issue, and that is you do not come back from a brain injury without the help of some degree of spirituality. And vice versa, there's something about a brain injury that oftentimes will make somebody more spiritual. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, your brain is what keeps you going. It's what makes every decision. It's what gets you to walk and talk and breathe and everything that you do. Okay. When it isn't working, who do you rely on? If your best performance is horrible, what are you going to do about it? And I do believe, I mean, I know for myself that it was a great epiphany for me, who had always been very self-reliant, always taking care of everybody else's problems as well as my own, when I suddenly couldn't figure out simple tasks at work in particular. So I think that you become reliant on a greater power, whatever that is. And I prefer to rely on the greatest power, thinking that if anybody was going to get me better, you know, it had to be this God source, this grace source, this all-knowing intelligent source to kind of help me through that. Now, there is a very interesting book. I'm trying to think of the name of the doctor who wrote it. I think his name was Melvin Morris, and the title of the book is Where God Lives. And he's talking about the right brain, the creative brain, the part of your brain where new ideas creep up. And I will say that I didn't read it until 2 years after my recovery, and I said that's what did it for me, because I was perfectly a left brain person. For those in the audience, that's a science math person. I knew science, I knew math, I knew new history. I didn't care about music, I didn't do art. I was pure science. But the thing is, when that was gone and my left brain wasn't working, I had to rely on my right brain. So as I said early on, I began to speak by singing, because music could help me get words out, whereas actual speaking did not. I began doing things like meditation. And interestingly enough, it was that creative part of my brain that brought me back. And when Dr. Peter was talking about that moment, you know, I remember the daydreaming moment. I wrote this down when you were talking about daydreaming. I remember being at church, and the priest was giving an incredibly long and boring sermon, and this was about 6 months into my TBI, and I started doodling on the bulletin. And before I knew it, by the end of his sermon, I had composed the lyrics and the music for a song. And that had never happened to me before. And I remember looking at that bulletin. I still have that bulletin. And I said, okay, where did this come from? And that's when I realized my brain was coming back, but not at all the brain that I knew. And I was going to somehow have to come to grips with this brain, with this new way of looking at the world, which is actually a little bit of a kinder, gentler way. And that's what I see when I see my struggling warriors coming back from war, because war is a left brain activity. It's strategic. It's, you know, react and fight, and a lot going on kind of in the more animalistic part of your brain, the fight or flight part of your brain. But the more cerebral part is the part that will teach them again art and music and writing and filmography. And that's why in so many instances when you're reading USA Today or you're reading in the New York Times, they talk about art therapy for the veterans and they talk about the music therapy. It is bringing that right brain back. I think the most interesting line that I can remember in the musical Rent was when the one gentleman turns to the audience and he said, the opposite of war isn't peace, it's creation. And I have said, I get a little choked up now because I believe that that particular phrase has saved the life of no fewer than 26 young men that I spoke to face to face who were at the depths of depression, on many antidepressants, by the way, but at the depths of depression, and they would grab my wrist and say, so Doc, you don't think I'm crazy? And they're like, my God, you just survived four tours of duty in a land that is four or five centuries behind culturally, in the most terrible fighting conditions we have ever had, which is a every single minute of every single day something can happen to you. I said, no, I don't think you're crazy. I think you're a survivor. And you only survived by using all of the cleverness you had in your brain. So let's, you know, forget about the fact you can't balance your checkbook. Let's talk about some of that cleverness in your brain. You know, or bringing them back to sports and trying to do something a little bit different with that. So I am a huge believer that you have to get something bigger than yourself to draw you out of it. Because your brain is the top of you. What's bigger than that? Your soul.
Well, that, you know, you're going right where I was going to ask you. You know, you're speaking clearly with the sense that you are not your brain. And I often tell that to people I work with. You are not your brain. Your brain may have been injured by drugs or injured by shock treatment, but you are not the brain. The machinery's busted up, but you're there.
Right.
You're your same wonderful self. And have you always had that feeling, or did that feeling develop after the injury?
That feeling developed after the injury, for sure. Before, trust me, before this, I really did like my brain. My brain had always served me well. And, you know, kind of being kind of the Irish prankster kind of person, the thing that you love about your brain is that long Irish memory where you can call upon humor again. You know, 10 years later, you're sitting at the dinner table and you bring up something that somebody did 10 years ago. So I always liked that. But man, when it was gone, I said, what is there about me? And it was the first that I realized that I really was a survivor. I'd had a pretty, you know, my life had been, you know, ups and downs as everybody is, but I mean, I always had an easy life. This became hard, you know. At this moment, it became hard, and I said, you know what? I really want to go through with it. Let me see. Now, there was a moment I wasn't sure I was going to go through with it. And I will say that when I talk to my young heroes coming back, and they talk about the depths of when, you know, you really feel like you're no good to anybody. Like, you can't take care of anybody. You can't even take care of yourself. So what good is it to be there? I came to that too. And, you know, that was a very interesting moment for me. And I said, okay, I'm going to have to do something to get out of it. So I gave myself 6 months. In 6 months, if I don't feel better with what I'm doing here, we'll talk about this again, but not for 6 months. And I kind of do that with my young little heroes. I say, okay, we're going to quit talking about how you know, feeling so down right now. Here's what I need you to do for the next time we talk. Mission-driven, being mission-driven. And one thing about our all-volunteer military, these young men and women are mission-driven. And they are also, we don't call them service personnel for no reason. We call them that because they are here to provide service. And when you over-medicate them, when you discharge them from the military service because they can no longer be a soldier, it doesn't mean that their life is over. And that's what we in the civilian world need to teach them.
Tell me some more about the spirituality that you've seen in the soldiers and some of the stories you've told me. And I remember sitting around at a lunch table with a colonel who had had an amazing experience. I think he was a colonel.
Right.
But tell us some more about other people's experiences of spirituality in terms of the head injury issues.
Well, you know, I don't think any is quite as realistic as a colonel. So why don't you tell the colonel's story briefly? Because that was pretty interesting.
I don't want to test my memory. It never was like yours. But I guess he had a visitation from a soldier.
Yes.
Well, was he telling that story about somebody else? That was about him.
No, it was right. You know, he had a visitation from one of his soldiers who had passed on.
Who was killed in combat.
Right.
And I can't remember the content of it. Maybe you can. But one of the things that was striking was that after the soldier left, then some medical people or somebody came in and said, who is that man who just left?
Yeah, I think it was the soldier kind of came to warn him because he was ignoring symptoms where he had the tumor in his brain and spinal cord, and he had been ignoring symptoms for quite some time. Actually, it was kind of a complex thing where fluid had collected around his spine from an injury in Vietnam. And this soldier actually came in and was the reason why he got help for it. And there have been several instances in my soldiers where they really do almost feel like, you know, a buddy who died, a comrade who died, kind of came back with them, you know. And I said, you know, maybe they did. You know, maybe there is a part of them in whatever existence there may be after who is trying to take care of you and pull you out of this. Because the worst thing that our young heroes have, I think, is that survival guilt, you know, where the guy standing right next to them gets blown up by an IED, by a bomb, and they survive. And that's very, very hard on this very young population. I mean, our all-voluntary military, these are kids 18, 19, 20, 21. You know, this is not a group of people who have been trained, you know, in Army techniques prior to just graduating from high school and enlisting. You know, it's just Carl Marlantis, I'm going to bring, who is the author of Matterhorn and What It's Like to Go to War, Vietnam veteran, who I absolutely, I really adore this man. He was a Rhodes Scholar and was actually at Oxford and was happy to be out of the war when he got this calling that he really needed to join the service and help his country in the war in Vietnam. And he said that at the battlefield, in the battlefield, life and death hang by a thread, which is true. And he said in many instances when he was in battle, he would see the other world coming to get the person in this world and vice versa, or you would sense it. And people would sense that kind of thing. And I do believe that there is a certain degree that when your brain is damaged in this world, you become a little bit more extrasensory about the other world or about things that happen in people's lives. I mean, I know after my own head injury, although I was somewhat intuitive prior to it, afterwards, my degree of intuitiveness actually bothered the heck out of me. Really would bother the heck out of me. So I remember walking into a patient's room, and the gentleman's last name was so-and-so senior. And I, for some reason, I stopped at the door. I go, why does he call himself senior? You know, how does somebody get to be a senior versus a junior? How does that happen? So I walked in, and I mentioned to him, you know, I don't know why I keep wanting to ask you how you got to be a senior. And he said, I've been thinking of dropping that. And I said, okay. He said, my son was a junior, and he died 5 years ago today. And I looked at him, and I said, I don't think he wants you to drop the senior. You know? I mean, those kind of issues had never happened to me prior to the rearrangement of my brain. None of those issues had happened to me before. And suddenly I get this knowledge about people that I have no business knowing. And I think that that happens to some of our heroes coming back too, because they have dealt with life and death as well as brain injury, as well as PTSD for a long time. And it kind of makes the things in this world seem so superficial to the things in other worlds, things like goodness and companionship and all of the different values that they live by, integrity and courage and whatnot. Those values become more, and your ability to deal with somebody who's had a bad hair day, you know, becomes a lot less, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, I really am very, very interested in just hearing more stories. We've got about 6 minutes. It reminds me of my friend Kevin, who's gone now, who thought that psychosis, the people who got labeled schizophrenic and so on, was actually a person whose filter was letting more of spirituality through than they could bear. And maybe the filter gets jostled, you know, would be one way of looking at it, or the filter, whatever that means,
well,
somehow.
Well, really, the lack of filtering is the hallmark of a mild PBI. The lack of the ability to filter, which is why, just like my soldiers and my Marines, I don't go into major department stores. I don't go into huge marketplaces or grocery stores. I don't do that. Because I still, and this is like 12 years later, I still cannot filter all of that out. So that's a very good point. I think that that does have something to do with, I think you bring in more, you filter less, and because of that you're more open. And I think that that kind of give and take of the spirituality of whatever sense of goodness and grace there is out there is what you have to let in, you know?
Do you have a feeling that God, or what, you know, God means so much different things to us, is active in your life and in the life of the soldiers and in the life of your relationships with them?
You know, I do believe that. I've always been, you know, kind of a God-driven kind of person. Although I will say this, before my head injury, I was in charge. After my head injury, I had to let somebody else be in charge. So that was it was definitely a defining moment. And it's a moment that defined what I've done and what I will continue doing for the rest of my life. So, you know, pretty dramatic event. And I say, you know, something that dramatic had to happen to me because I was too stubborn to listen to the small signs. You know, so people out there, beware. Listen to the small signs. You know? Don't wait for that IED blast or that, you know, concussion to knock you out. Yeah, try to listen to the smaller signs. I really do believe that. And I don't have any kind of... I guess God, as you say, can be in multiple different forms, you know. I mean, not necessarily will people have the Irish Catholic upbringing that I do, which is very superstitious and which serves me well as well. But I find that there's a certain spirituality. Some of the warriors who have done the best coming back actually were two young men who were Buddhists. And the interesting thing was they had been meditating since they were small. So in the midst of some very horrific fighting in Fallujah, which was by everybody's standards the worst battle in the history of mankind, they were able to take themselves out for a period of time. Both of them were medics, by the way. They were able to take themselves out of the horror that they were seeing for a few moments, gain their composure, and come back. And I find that a remarkable trait, don't you?
Oh, I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
I think it's really, really interesting. But before your injury, would you have called yourself a purpose-driven kind of person? Or,
oh, yes, I guess, but it was my purpose.
Yeah, you were Summa. Was it college or med school? Med school?
Yes.
I mean, you got to be driven and brilliant. You got to have a great machine and some drivenness, especially in medical school level, to do that.
Well, my claim to fame there is not that I was the first of the class, but that I was the youngest member of the class. That was my claim to fame, because that was during the Vietnam era. So most of the people in my class had been people who kept going to school. Remember, Peter, because if you got the school deferment, you weren't drafted, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So many of the people that were in my class were 27, 28, 29, and I kind of went in there at 21 thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to get creamed. And I decided I wasn't going to let that happen. So I was very, very lucky with that. And but again, it was something I thought that I was in charge of, and I was wrong.
Do you feel that your machinery is fully recovered? I think you're going to say no from everything.
Oh,
you're
absolutely not. Oh, not at all. Not at all.
You took this neuropsych test that would show some injury.
Oh, I'd be afraid to take it. I know that there would be. I've got to estimate that my IQ points are down 15 to 20. And at the time of the injury, I mean, for about the first year, I really had trouble functioning. I couldn't learn anything new, you know, let me put it that way. And that's like, that was not compatible with my lifestyle at all. So yeah, there's been a definite change. The other difference though is this, the old me would have never been so bold as to go to people in the Veterans Administration also or the DOD and say, hey, we can make this better. I wouldn't be so bold as to be talking to you. No, the old me wouldn't have done that. So, you know.
I want to tell folks, we're finishing up now.
Okay.
I'm finishing with my friend and my esteemed colleague, Chrisanne Gordon. Everything Chrisanne is saying has a correlation in my own practice. I've worked with physicians and engineers and other people over the years who have been injured by shock treatment and drugs and head injuries, who have literally gone on to live better lives than they ever imagined. And the same is true for people who have, you know, terrible psychotic experiences, which I generally view as post-trauma to childhood. So it's still in that realm of PTS. And again, you can go on to live a better life than you ever imagined. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, and keep on pressing like you do. We really appreciate everything you do.
And I appreciate everything you do. Thank you so much, Chrisanne.
Bye-bye.